basically, this shir is in this series is in a nutshell that the classic Gemara shir. In some ways, classic Gemara shiurim are a staple of every shul. I personally have always struggled with them, not even as a rabbi, but as an attendee. Because after a while, I feel they can start to get a little, you know, after a while, they lose a bit of focus. And you find yourself just to ad infinitum, going through page after page, line after line of Gemara. And unless that's Daf Yomi, where you're doing that intentionally to build to a point, it can feel a bit torturous. So this is my take on the classic Gemara shir, where we're going to be looking at a very specific focus, and we're going to be spending 3 weeks investigating what's going to amount to just a few lines of the Gemara. And we're going to be talking about Hanukkah. And I'm going to use two terms interchangeably. One is the Hebrew, Neirot Hanukkah, and one is the English, Hanukkah candles. If you are pedantic, and I love being pedantic, but there's only so pedantic even I can be, Hanukkah candles is a very imprecise term. Neirot Hanukkah, Hanukkah lights, it just sounds awkward, so I'm going to instinctively talk about Hanukkah candles. But that's what we're going to be investigating. That's what we're going to be diving deeply into. And as we are going to see, and really there's not so much more of a lengthy introduction because the sources are going to start speaking for themselves, we're going to start seeing the questions emerge as we start learning these first few sources. But we're going to start diving deeply into the obligation that we have coming up in now, not long. It's the 9th of Kislev already, so we have less than 20 days. That's about the best mental arithmetic you're going to get from me right now. We have less than 20 days until Hanukkah, and this mitzvah is going to be relevant. So at this point, we're already going to, I'm already going to share the source sheet. Okay, hopefully you can all see the source sheet. And we are going to begin with source number one, which is from the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. Interestingly, there is obviously no Masechet Hanukkah. There is no tractate of the Gemara that deals explicitly with the laws of Hanukkah. Instead, it's found in just a few pages of the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. And the reason the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat starts talking about this is the second parak of Masechet Shabbat, Bamemar Likin, we read the Mishnayot every Friday night, and deals with the lighting of Shabbat candles. And the Gemara is not arranged topically in a particularly strong way. It's often arranged associatively. And so once the Gemara is already discussing the obligation to light Shabbat candles, before you know it, it's kind of twisted and turned towards talking about Hanukkah candles instead. Basically, everything and anything that is to know about Hanukkah is found in just a few pages of the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. And so we read, source number one, a fascinating, fascinating Gemara. And I'm gonna read it, and then I'm going to talk a bit about it, because this in and of itself is fascinating. So the Gemara says, source number one, Tanu Rabbanan, introduces us to a brighter, which is a work, a text, a source from the Tanaitic period, 0 through 200 CE. This is the era that gave us the Mishnah, but it also gave us much more than the Mishnah. So the Gemara often quotes these kinds of sources, and we read the following, Mitzvat Hanukkah, the obligation of lighting Hanukkah candles, Ner Ish Ubeito. A very, very difficult phrase to translate, and basically we're going to spend the next however long obsessing over these three words. The very bad translation is like a light per person and his house, which is a very unhelpful translation, but just so no one's completely in the dark of what those three words roughly mean, we are going to obsess over what these three words mean, but let's just read the rest of it first. V'homahadrin. And then the mehuda, the greater, the more perfect way of performing this mitzvah, ner lechol echad vo echad, each and every person, there is a light for each of them. And then finally, v'hamahadrin min hamahadrin, the most perfect version, Beit Shammai Omrim. Beit Shammai said, Yom Rishon Madlik Shmona Mikan Ve'elech Pachad V'Cholech, that on the first night you light eight, and then you keep on decreasing by one every single night, so that the final night of Hanukkah you just have one flame left. Uveit Hillel Omrim, Yom Rishon Madlik Achat Mikan Ve'elech Mosif V'Cholech. And then Beit Hillel says, on the first night you light one, and then from that day forth you keep on adding one more until on the final day you have eight. And there is so much so many questions emerge from just these few lines. And this is what we are going to obsess over the next few weeks. I already mentioned Nehru Issue Beto. Something, I'm not sure how much we'll end up discussing it, but something fascinating here is that the Gemara makes reference here to the concept of Mahajir and the idea of Hidur Mitzvah. This is a well-known principle in Halacha, that there are ways to perform a mitzvah, and then there are nicer ways to perform a mitzvah. Perhaps the classic example of Hidur Mitzvah is an etrog on Sukkot. You buy an etrog, but you could buy a more mehuda etrog. You could buy a more beautiful etrog. You buy yourself a nicer version of an etrog. Okay, that is Hidur Mitzvah. That's a beautification of the mitzvah. The usual way we assume Hidur Mitzvah works is you do the same thing as everyone else. You just do a slightly nicer version of it. Here at Hanukkah, we are treated to something completely unique. That the Mahadrin way, the Hidur Mitzvah, is a completely new way of doing the mitzvah. In and of itself, this is mind-blowing. The Gemara told us the fundamental way is Ner Ish Ubeto, whatever exactly that means. But then there's this completely new way to do it for Mahadrin. And then this is another completely new way to do it, Mahadrin and Mahadrin. This is completely unique, completely unusual in the entirety of Halacha, something we'll have to figure out another time. Something else, and this is what we will talk about next week, is this question of Mahadrin and Mahadrin min Mahadrin. The way we might typically translate it is you have level one, Ner Ish Ubeto. Then you have level two, that's the Mahadrin. And then you have the Mahadrin min Mahadrin, which is level three. Alternatively, you could suggest that Mahadrin is level 2A, and Mahadrin min Mahadrin is actually level 2B. It's not three different levels, but two different levels, where level two is two possible different ways of understanding it. This is what we are going to begin to dwell on next week. What we are going to try and focus on tonight is what exactly Ner Ish Ubeto means. But before we start talking about that, what I love so much about learning specifically in depth things we do is that, look, we all know how to light Hanukkah candles. And we all know what we do. And there is a chance every single person does, when reading source one, was like, yeah, that looks basically like what I do. Different people might do slightly different looking things, but we all know what to do. And so we live this life where we don't need to investigate in depth why exactly we do things. And yet what we're going to see is when we start to scratch just a little below the surface, so much depth, so much complexity starts to emerge that it helps enrich our understanding of Hanukkah. And so that's really the large long-term goal of this, is that come the 25th of Kislev, come Hanukkah, by our understanding of the mitzvah we are performing, by digging deep into the very thing that is the center of our observance of Hanukkah, we will have an enriched experience. We will have a greater appreciation of what we are doing. So now comes the question. What does Ner Ish Ubeto mean? The Gemara told us this is the fundamental level. The one thing you need to do on Hanukkah. Every night of Hanukkah is this Ner Ish Ubeto. But it's a very confusing phrase. And the truth is, most in-depth halacha specifically takes root at ambiguous phrases, at things that are difficult to understand. If it was very clear, if it was very obvious, there wouldn't be that much to talk about. But what do you do when you come across a phrase you don't understand in the Gemara? So nowadays, you look it up in Art Scroll, or you go on sfaria.org, where they have the entirety of the Steinsaltz Koran translation online, and you click it, you look it up, fine. What did most people do for most of Jewish history? You look at Rashi, which is printed on every single page of the Gemara, bar a few famous exceptions, but Rashi is there. He was Art Scroll before Art Scroll existed. His goal is to explain those things that are hard to understand. And so what do we do to understand Ner Ish Ubeto? We look at Rashi source number two, and he tells us what it means. And he says, Ner echad b'chol laila, one light every single night. V'ish v'chol b'nei beito, sagiluhu b'ner echad, and every single person in that house, it's good to just have one light. The fundamental mitzvah of Hanukkah, says Rashi, understanding the Gemara, is simply light one candle every single night. Night one, light one. Light seven, light one. Night seven, light one. No matter what night of Hanukkah it is, you light one candle. It doesn't matter how many people are in your home. One candle. Just one ner is enough to fulfill the mitzvah. That's what Rashi says. Now, if all we were doing, let's say we were learning Daf Yomi, or let's say this was a Gemara Shir where our goal was to try and get through, you know, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Bet, 21b of Masechet Shabbat, we'd look at Rashi and boom, we'd move on. But it's not a problem with Rashi because it's a feature, not a bug. But there's a methodological issue with Rashi. And that is that Rashi is what we'd call a local commentator. Rashi's entire goal is to merely get you through the line you just read. He just wants to explain it. He has no interest in trying to figure out more broadly what exactly this means. He's not the guy to go to. Rashi's never the commentator to go to for more in-depth trying to figure out how what we just read fits more broadly within the world of halacha. That's not Rashi's jam. That's not what Rashi's trying to do. All he wants to do is get you through those words. This is why Rashi can sometimes be inconsistent, because he doesn't care. He just wants to get you through that daf. This is why Rashi is usually very terse. If you ever see Rashi explaining something at length, if you ever see Rashi cross-referencing other topics from Gemara, that's a sign you need to panic. Because what he's essentially telling you is there is no way to understand what you are reading unless you are aware of 15,000 other things. That's why he's explaining them. But usually, all Rashi wants to do is get you through the line. And so if that's all we wanted to do, boom, we know it. We can sign off. Good night, everyone. We now know what the basic fulfillment of the mitzvah of Chanukah is. One light per night, every night, that's it. That's all. But we're going to dig a little deeper. We are going to try and scratch a little bit below the surface and start trying to take a more global view. Whereas Rashi is local, there are other commentators who are global. And the most famous global commentators are the Ba'alei HaTosfot, the school of Tosfot. They get printed. Also, where Rashi is printed on the inside page of a Gemara facing the spine, Tosfot always printed on the outside of the page, whatever, you know, next to the edge of the page. Tosfot it's an entire school of thought, France, Germany, medieval era. It was really started by Rashi's sons-in-law and his grandsons. They are some of the most famous Ba'alei HaTosfot. They take a far more holistic approach to explaining the Gemara. They aren't interested. They have zero care in helping you navigate a specific line. Their question is always, how does this fit within the wider world of Shas? If you survey the entire Talmudic corpus, how does what we just read fit into that puzzle? Every single time you read a Tosafot, that's essentially the question they are asking. That's always what they are trying to figure out. And so, while Rashi just wanted to explain the simplest understanding of Ner Ish Uveto, Tosafot are about to explode our entire understanding of the fundamental mitzvah of Chanukah, and in doing so, open an entire world of thought to us. But before we read Tosafot, we have to read another Gemara, because this is classic Tosafot. In order to appreciate what they're saying, you have to have a greater awareness than the line you're just reading. And so there is another quote of the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, just a few pages after what we just read, which tells us something really interesting. It's source number 3. Amar Rav Chiya bar Ashi Amar Rav. Hamadlik ner shel Chanukah, if you are lighting Hanukkah candles. Sarich levarich. You need to make a bracha. Okay, nothing interesting there. We assumed as much. V'rav Yirmiyah Amar, but we have an additional opinion. Haroe ner shel Hanukkah sarich levarich. If you see Hanukkah candles, let's say a few, we know it's less than 20, and I can't bother doing any more of the mental arithmetic. You walk past my, it will be, you know, 20 nights from now, you'll walk past my house and you'll see my Hanukkah candles in the window. Says this Gemara, you see them, you have to make a bracha. Fascinating, not something we are familiar with. Amar Rav Yehuda, and then we get a bit of a, we get some details of what those brachot are. Amar Rav Yehuda, Yom Rishon Haroa Mevarech Shtayim, Umadlik Mevarech Shalosh, Mikan Ve'elach, Madlik Mevarech Shtayim, Veroa Mevarech Achat. And this is how it works. On the first night, if you're lighting, there are three brachot to make, whereas on the, if you're seeing, there are two brachot to make. Every other night, if you're lighting, there are two brachot to make, and if you're seeing, there are one brachot, there is one brachot to make. What's the difference? Well, there are, think of the brachot we make on the first night. We make the brachot of Asher Kidshanu B'mitzvot HaBitzimanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, who has commanded us to light the Chanukah candles. There is Sha'asa Nisim, we thank God for the miracles. And then on the first night, there's Shehecheyanu. Obviously, if you are seeing the lights but not lighting, you don't make the special bracha of Asher Kidshanu B'mitzvot HaBitzimanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah to light the Chanukah lights, because you're not doing it. So you just make the bracha of Sha'asa Nisim, and on the first night, Shehecheyanu, as the Gemara says, my mema'it, what do you skip? Mema'it zman, you skip Shehecheyanu after the first night. V'nimot neis, why not get rid of the bracha of Sha'asa Nisim? Neis kol yome'ita, we need to make that bracha because there was a miracle. The miracle is relevant all the nights of Chanukah. But we are treated to this really fascinating principle that it's not just that there is an obligation, there is not just a mitzvah to light Chanukah candles, but there is some sort of expectation upon seeing Chanukah candles that you also make a bracha. And this is where Tosafot come in. What's really interesting, as I scroll down now to source number 4 in the Tosafot, you will see that this is found in the Gemara in Sukkah. Tosafot are not commenting here in Masechet Shabbat. Until now, we've only been in Masechet Shabbat, which, as I told you, is where you'll find the discussion of Chanukah. Tosafot are coming at this. We come across their opinion here in Masechet Sukkah. Why? Because they're global. What just happened in the Gemara in Sukkah that's relevant, you know, where Tosafot are commenting on, is it just quoted what we read, source number 3. The Gemara in Sukkah also brings it to prove that you make a bracha on the Arba Minim every day of Sukkot. It brought that up. It seemed to compare Arba Minim, Lulav, Etrog, etc., etc., to Chanukah candles. And this leads Tosafot to ask the following question. Source number 4. B'sha'ar mitzvot, kagon alulav v'suka, lo takinu levarich l'roa, ela legabe ner Chanukah. Why does Chanukah have this special rule that you make a bracha upon seeing Chanukah candles being lit? On Sukkot, when you walked into shul, you saw someone waving Arba Minim, you didn't have your own, there's no bracha to make. On Pesach, there's no bracha to make on eating matzah. There's no bracha to make seeing someone else sit in their sukkah. Why on earth is Chanukah unique in that there is a bracha merely upon seeing the mitzvah having been performed? What's so special about it? So Tosafot gives two answers. One, Mishum Chavivot HaNeis, because the miracle is so precious to us. We appreciate that miracle so much that we kind of double down on all the possible opportunities to thank God for it. But it's the second answer that's more interesting for us. V'gam mishum sheyesh kama b'nei Adam she'ein lohem batim. Because there are a lot of people that don't own houses. V'ein biyadam l'koyim ha-mitzvah. and thus they have no opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles. We'll come back to that in a second, because that's crucial and mind-blowing of a statement. Then Tosfot Hamas say, V'tam Rishon Nicha, they prefer the first answer, not the one I just read, the one that the miracle is more precious. Delati kashe le mezuzah, because it doesn't present us with a problem of mezuzah. I'll explain what that means soon. Va'od yesh lefarish de'ein shayach letakin l'roa bracha she'ein ha'uzah mavarach. And also because we don't want to institute a separate bracha where the person who sees the mitzvah being performed would make a bracha that the person performing the mitzvah wouldn't make. The key thing for us is this line here. She'yesh kama b'nei adam she'ein lohem batim ve'ein bi'adam l'kayam ha'mitzvah. If you don't have a house, you can't fulfill the mitzvah. And this introduces us to an entirely different way of thinking about mitzvot. And it introduces us to an important distinction. And what's known as a chovat gavra, an obligation upon yourself, and a chovat bayit, an obligation upon your house. Most of the mitzvot we do are obligations upon ourselves. You have to eat matzah on Pesach. You have to bench lulav. You have to sit in a sukkah. You have to hear shofar. You have to blow shofar. You have to hear shofar. You have to do these things. You have to read Megillah. You have to hear Megillah. You have to do it. Those are most mitzvot we associate. You have to go out and do it. That was why. When it came to Rosh Hashanah time, we made sure, thank Ariel Brudley, did this wonderful, amazing service for the community where he went around Pinehurst blowing the shofar for basically anyone who needed it, because you had an obligation to hear shofar. You had to hear it even though you couldn't come to shul. That's how most mitzvot work. You have to do it. But there's a separate class of mitzvot, a much smaller list of mitzvot. And the classic example is a mezuzah, where you don't have to do it unless the situation is activated, unless you find yourself in the situation. And in this particular case, it's you own a home. If you don't own a home, if you don't live in a home, nowadays it is, thank God, hard for us to imagine, but for most of Jewish history and for a lot of people still in this world, it's actually not that hard to imagine. If you don't own a home, you don't have to put up a mezuzah. There's no obligation you have to put up a mezuzah for the sake of putting up a mezuzah. That's not how it works. You don't go knocking on neighbors' houses asking to fulfill the mitzvah of mezuzah. It doesn't work. But if you own a home or you're renting a home, all of a sudden, and really it's after 30 days, bing, an alarm goes off. You are now obligated to put up a mezuzah. It's a chovat bayit. It's an obligation upon not you, but your home. And because it's on your home, you have to do it. Your home has to have a mezuzah. You have to eat matzah on Pesach. You have to sit in a sukkah. Your home has to have a mezuzah. That's the difference. Two very different things, because you are always you, but you might not always have a home. And this, says Tosafot, is also how lighting Hanukkah candles works. Your home must have Hanukkah candles lit within it. How do they understand ner ish ubeito? Again, it's a very confusing phrase, a light per person and his house. They emphasize, whereas Rashi underscored the ish, the individual aspect, Tosafot underscores the beito, the house. It's actually an obligation on the house to have a candle lit. And this explains the mezuzah. Why doesn't Tosafot actually want to think about... Tosafot basically say they don't want to think about this too much because it creates huge problems with mezuzah. Because if you're supposed to make a bracha upon seeing Hanukkah candles, if you don't own a home, then theoretically you'd also have to make a bracha upon seeing a mezuzah, and we don't do that if you don't actually own one. But the idea here is that this idea of making a bracha upon seeing Neirat Hanukkah is because you weren't able to fulfill the mitzvah. So if you walk past my house on Hanukkah, if you already lit Hanukkah candles, ostensibly you don't need to make any bracha. But if you weren't able to for one reason or another, then you'd have to. But the crucial distinction for us is this idea that Hanukkah candles are either a chovat gavra. It's an obligation you must do. You must light Hanukkah candles. Or alternatively, it's a chovat bayit. It's an obligation that your house must have Hanukkah candles lit within it. Rashi, from what we saw, Rashi could have, in trying to just explain it easily, gone the house route, but he didn't. So it's very clear, it's very obvious that Rashi views this as a chovat gavra. Rashi thinks the obligation on Hanukkah is for you to light Hanukkah candles, and as long as one person's done it, everyone kind of folds into that one person's lighting. Tosafot, however, view it differently. It's on the house. And it's not just Tosafot who thinks so. Take a look at source number five. Source number five is Rambam. Rambam, who is one of the most precise worders of halacha, says the following. Source five. Kama neirot hu madlik b'chanukah. How many lights are lit on Hanukkah? This is where, and I didn't include the rest of the source, and I probably should have, he basically rewrites in his own language source one. He rewrites in his own language the Gemara in Shabbat. How does he rewrite Ner Ish Ubeito? Mitzvata sheyihya kol bayit ubayit. The mitzvah is that in each and every house, madlik ner echad, one candle should be lit. Bein shahayu anshe habayit merubin, bein shalo hayabo ela adam echad. Whether there's one person or a lot of people, but the key thing is, in each and every house, one light should be lit. That's the point. And what's really fascinating is in another place, Rambam gives us a potential reason as to why specifically the mitzvah's on the house. In his, he has a letter, his Ma'amar Kiddush Hashem. He gives a little recap of the Hanukkah story, and he gives a really interesting insight, perspective, understanding of what the oppression was on Hanukkah. Source number six. V'yaduhu kumo kein im shakara liYisrael b'malchut Yavan harasham gzeirat kashot v'ra'ot. Here are some of the terrible things. You know, the Seleucids did terrible things upon us. Umiklalalim haya shelo yisku adam et petach beito. And one of the things was a prohibition against closing the door of the house. Never heard of this outside of Rambam, but kedei shelo yit yocheid lehitosik b'shom mitzvah, so that there would be no privacy. No one would be able to close the door and perform a mitzvot. Says Rambam, the entirety of the oppression of Hanukkah, or a key part of the Hanukkah oppression, was on the Jews' houses. And so it actually makes sense, when you think about it, that we would celebrate the miracle of having been redeemed, of having been freed from our oppression, with a mitzvah that explicitly relates to our houses. So we have this distinction. On the one hand, you could argue compellingly that the mitzvah of Hanukkah is probably what you thought it was until, you know, 10 minutes ago. Just like all the other mitzvah we do, you have to do it. You have to eat matzah, you have to bench lulav, you have to light Hanukkah candles. But now we've been introduced to this fascinating alternative perspective, which is no. You don't. You just have to ensure that your house has a Hanukkah candle lit within it. There are a couple of directions to go with this distinction. One way is to go the what we'd call the nafka mina route, to try and start teasing out some practical differences. Halachically speaking, what changes depending on whether it's a chovat bayit or chovat gavra? So one famous kind of, you know, consequence might be if you own more than one home. If you own more than one home, do you have to have make sure mezuzot are in all of them? Yeah, you have to make sure there are mezuzot up in all your homes. If you own more than one home and it's a chovat bayit, do you need to make sure there's a Hanukkah, at least one candle lit per night in your house, even if you're not there? Do you have to call, you know, your Jewish neighbors and be like, oh, hi, can you just run over and, you know, there's a key out back and just light one light each night? If it's a chovah by it, potentially, yes. If it's chovah gavra, no, it doesn't matter. You just have to do it. And it doesn't matter where you are. But if it's a chovat by it, then potentially you might have to ensure at least one light is lit in the window of each, and you know, in the window of your home. And if you have more than one home, you have to make sure, you know, each one has at least a candle lit in one window. Another potential practical difference is, you know, what happens if you're running late? You know, there used to be a day when we didn't all work at home. And the idea of, I remember back in the day now, I feel old, fully aware that I'm one of the youngest people on the call, and that's just made everyone else very angry for saying that I feel old. But when I was in NYU, and we lived in a place called Highland Park, New Jersey, if I took the train door to door, it was a 2-hour trip each way. It was not fun. And even if I got a ride back with someone, some of you are familiar with Rabbi Schwartzberg, he also lived in Highland Park, so he worked at YU, so he often gave me a ride back. Still, it was like over an hour. So what happens, you know, winter time, Hanukkah candle time. You know, you light Hanukkah candles, I don't know exactly what time, but it's early. But what if I'm not going to be home until, you know, 7 o'clock, 7:30, 8? The time for Hanukkah candles was way earlier. Really, we should, you know, we should fulfill the mitzvah as soon as possible. Is it better, you know, for Ruthie to wait, who's at home, so that I can fulfill the mitzvah because it's my mitzvah? Or is it better for just light someone light a Hanukkah candle? It doesn't matter. What if it's a chovat gavra? It's on me. It would also be on Ruthie, but ignore that kind of aspect for a second. But if it's a chovat gavra, I kind of have a problem right now because it's going to take me a long time to get home. If it's a chovat bayit, then just light the candles, who cares? Because ultimately, as long as my apartment has a flame in the window, I fulfilled the mitzvah, even if I'm still stuck 2 hours away. So one angle to take is this kind of nafkamina angle. Oh, someone raised a hand. I got a notification, someone raised their hand.
Yeah. It's Mindy.
Hello.
Hi. Can you translate those two terms you're using, please? I don't know if you're saying chovan or horban. I'm not familiar.
Obligation. So chovat, a chovat gavra is an obligation upon you. So you have to eat matzah. You have to sit in a sukkah. A chovat bayit is an obligation upon your house. So your house has to have a mezuzah in it. And the question becomes Hanukkah candles. Do you have to light Hanukkah candles, or does your house have to have Hanukkah candles lit within it? And so there are at least a couple of different practical differences that may emerge. There's another angle, though, I'd prefer to take that I actually think is the more interesting route to take. And that is to realize that the second you have this distinction in mind, it solves so many other confusing halachic problems. It helps explain, it helps understand some statements that are otherwise pretty confusing and seemingly inconsistent. And we're going to see a few examples in a second. That by taking this distinction between whether Hanukkah candles is a chovat gavra, an obligation on you, or a chovat bayit, an obligation on your house, it can present, actually, this distinction itself can present more of a global solution to understanding some otherwise very perplexing sources. And the first example is, and I'm going to bring, I believe, two examples of this. There might be, it's terrible when I can't even remember how many sources I put on a source sheet that I literally just looked at again 5 minutes before the share started. But this is my life right now at 8:40 at night. I don't remember things. First example is also from the Gemara in Shabbat. The Gemara in Shabbat, in discussing the laws of Hanukkah, treats us to a fascinating and somewhat confusing debate. Source number 7. Amar Rav Sheshet. Ach Sanai Chayav Bener Chanukah. Rav Sheshet says that a guest is obligated in lighting the Chanukah candles wherever they are. So if you have someone, you know, living with you, says Rav Sheshet, you have to, that guest also has to light Chanukah candles. We get a different opinion. Amar Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira says, Meiresh ki havena be Rav. When I used to live, and when I studied in the yeshiva, Mishtat fana, Bifrite bahade ushpiza. I used to give some money to my host back in the day. Obviously, yeshiva didn't have dorms. For most of Jewish history, you lived at someone's house. What did Rabbi Zeira used to do? He used to basically pay. He used to give like the most minimal amount possible, but still a significant piece of money to the person he was staying at to join with him in the lighting of Chanukah candles. Bakar din sevi itata. After I got married, Amena, I said to my wife, Hashtavalai lo tzurichna, I no longer need to do this. The kamad laki alai bego betai, because she'll light on my behalf in my house. This Gemara is what's going on here. We just got a debate between two figures, Rav Sheshet and Rav Zeira. What are they debating about? The answer's obvious. This question, is the obligation of Chanukah on you or on your house? Rav Sheshet thinks it's on you. It's a Chovat Gavra. Source number 8 is the Ran. Commenting here, he says explicitly, Amar Rav Sheshet achsanai, orach, af al pi she'en lo bayit, a guest, even though he does not have his own home, de lo tema din ner Chanukah kedin mezuzah. We don't say it's like mezuzah. It's not on his house. De chol mi she'en lo bayit pato min ha-mezuzah, because anyone who doesn't have a house is exempt from mezuzah. That's not applicable here, says Rav Sheshet. You have an obligation to light Chanukah candles. Just as if you were a guest in someone's home on Pesach, one day in the near future, there'll be a Pesach where that will be a thing again. But if you are a guest at someone else's home on Pesach, you have to eat matzah. But you don't have to worry about putting up mezuzot. That's the difference. Says Rav Sheshet, you have to light Chanukah candles because it's on you. What about Rabbi Zeira? Why was he giving money to the host to essentially become an owner, to become a part owner in a legal sense, so that it was his bayit also? He wanted to fulfill the mitzvah. How is he going to fulfill the mitzvah of Neirot Chanukah? He doesn't have a home. So what did he do? It was a legal fiction, where he became, in some sense or another, a part owner on the house, so that now there was an obligation, and so he gets to light. What happened once he got married? He had a home, so his wife lit for him. There you go. Rav Sheshet thinks it's a chovat gavra, it's on you. Rav Zeira thought it was on his house, it was on the house, and so when he didn't have a house, he had to figure out a way to still get around this problem so that he could light Chanukah candles. This explanation, this distinction, is not just a contrived, created distinction. It's not just a distinction we find within the Rishonim, the medieval commentators, but it's actually rooted in the very understanding of the obligation of Chanukah candles. And this distinction can also help explain. Oh yeah, there are more sources. This distinction can also help explain a very interesting contradiction between two different halachot of the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo in his Shulchan Aruch, the defining code of Jewish law, codifies two different laws. Source number 9 is the laws of Chanukah. Source number 10 is the laws of Purim, the reading of the Megillah. They are very similar, but there is a crucial difference between the two. There's actually two. No, there's, well, the way you phrase it, whatever. There's a crucial difference. Source number 9. Isha madleket ner Chanukah she'af hi chayevet ba. A woman may light Chanukah candles because she is obligated. This is a fascinating principle we're not going to discuss. It's the principle known as Af Hein Hayu Ba'oto Hanes, that even though usually women are exempt from time-bound commandments, there are three exceptions to that rule: matzah on Pesach, hearing the Megillah, and Neirat Chanukah, because on all three, women were equal, you know, recipients of the miracle, and so they too have an equal obligation. So the Shulchan Aruch is saying a woman can light Chanukah candle, like, can usually, to take a take one step back, you can fulfill the obligations of someone else if you have an equal or greater mitzvah obligation. So come Friday night, you can make kiddush for an entire room of people. That used to be a thing, because you have the same, if everyone, you have the same or greater obligation as everyone else, you can fulfill their mitzvah. So the Shulchan Aruch is telling us here that because women are equally obligated in Neirat Chanukah, they can light Chanukah candles. It's not a problem. Aval, im, we're still now the third to last line on the first, the third to last word on the last, on the first line. Aval, im hidlika chiresh shoteva katan, lo asaklo. But if it was lit by, and this is the big three categories of people who are halachically exempt. The chiresh is the deaf mute. Doesn't really exist nowadays. It used to be that the assumption was if you were deaf, you couldn't understand anything. Nowadays, obviously, people who are deaf, thank God, are able to communicate, are able to understand things, are able to, you know, have the same successes, you know, those who can hear normally are able to have. But in most of, you know, history, if you were deaf, you also couldn't talk, and you basically weren't able to do anything. A shoter is also, now is not the time to kind of talk about this at length. It's way too sensitive and complicated a topic to talk about right now. It deserves its own treatment. Shoter is someone with, you know, severe mental disabilities. Why it's a fascinating topic in the year 2020 is because, again, the category of that is much smaller than it used to be. Because of all the various ways, you know, in society, psychology, all these various ways, you know, people can, you know, we can have very high functioning, you know, people in any way, no matter what they are born with, shota also. The key one for us is katan and a child. But cheresh, shota, and katan, these are the three big, they can't really perform mitzvot. Ya'ir, I hope he's asleep already, because if he heard my name, he's going to come down. If he heard me call his name, he's going to come down in a second. Ya'ir is five. He can't fulfill mitzvot for anyone because he's five. That's basically lo asaklum. So if Ya'ir lit Chanukah candles a few, you know, 20 nights from now, doesn't matter. The afal pisha hinicha gadol, even if an adult set it up, even if all we said was light the flame, doesn't work. But then the Shulchan Aruch adds something crucial. The Yesh Misha Omer, Bekatan Shehigia Lechinuch Mutter. But there are those who say that if a kid's reached the age of Chinuch, the age of education, I think we usually say six. Basically, once a kid's reached a certain age where they're no longer completely, they don't have a clue what's going on, but they can start to understand some things. Kids, it's not a hard and fast rule. But you, like Shai, who is two, literally doesn't know what's what. He could not be expected to do anything. Even Ye'e, who's five, can start to understand quite a few things. What the Shulchan Aruch is saying here is if you find a kid, even though they're technically exempt, if they know what they're doing, they can light Chanukah candles. Contrast this with source number 10, which is about reading the Megillah on Purim. Echad hakore ve'echad hashomea min hakore yatza yidei chovata. Whether you read the Megillah or you heard someone reading the Megillah, you fulfilled your obligation. V'hu sheyishma mipi shehu chayav b'kriyata. But you have to have heard it from someone who's also obligated in reading the Megillah. Lefichach, therefore, im haya hakora cheresh or katan or shota. If the person who read the Megillah was one of the big three, hashomea mimeno liyase, it doesn't matter. So if you heard, so the difference is, again, yeah, is five, he's not yet reached the age of chinuch. So imagine an 8-year-old boy, random 8-year-old boy in our community. Says the Shulchan Aruch, if random 8-year-old boy might be the best reader of Megillat Esther we've ever heard in our lives, doesn't matter. We listen, we wasted 40 minutes of our lives, nothing was achieved. If 8-year-old boy or girl lights Chanukah candles, there are those who say, no, that's fine. The obligation was fulfilled. There is an inconsistency here. the Shulchan Aruch is cool letting a kid of a certain age light Hanukkah candles, but not cool letting a kid read the Megillah. Why? You know the answer at this point. Because Megillah is a Chovat Gavra, but Hanukkah candles is a Chovat Bayit. You have to read or you have to hear the Megillah. So having someone who's exempt doesn't help. However, your house has to have Hanukkah candles lit. So you know what? If worse comes to worst, and the only person to light the Hanukkah candles at least knows what they are doing. They are at least in the realm of mitzvot obligations, which is a child who's reached the age of chinuch. As long as that kid lit a flame in the window, boom, the mitzvah is fulfilled because the house has a Hanukkah candle within it. If it's an obligation upon your house, the rules are slightly more relaxed. At the end of the day, as long as it's up, it's up. That's why, by the way, if you buy your house of someone who was previously a Jew, you don't need to put up mezuzah. Also, because as long as they're up, who cares? You don't need to do anything. But you have to listen to Megillah. It's on you. This distinction between Chovat Bayit and Chovat Gavra runs the thread of Hanukkah. And we are not done with it. We will be picking it up in the weeks to come once again, because we've only just started understanding this deep dive into the laws of Hanukkah. But there are a couple more sources which are fascinating that I want to end with. The first is Rambam, source number 11. Rambam, I must have mentioned this before, but Rambam is one of two halachic figures to have written a law code on the entirety of Jewish law. The Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Moshe Islis, all of these people, they only talk about things that are, quite frankly, relevant. And Rambam was one of two people to decide to also write laws of things like kings and wars and all the laws regarding the Beit HaMikdash. That's how thorough he was. The other person was Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan. He passed away in the 1900s. What we're going to look at in a second is Rambam's laws of the Beit HaMikdash. At the end of the day, why do we light a menorah on Hanukkah? Because it's tied to the miracle of oil that lasted for 8 days rather than one. That miracle of oil was what fueled the lighting of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. And so we light our own menorah to celebrate the lighting of that menorah. There is supposed to be a clear, direct link, in a sense, between the menorah in our window and the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. There's a fascinating rule of that menorah in the Beit HaMikdash, which is the following. Source number 11. V'chein hadlakat haneirot kashera bezarim. Anyone could light the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. A non-Kohen. I know BIAV is a shul of 99% Kohanim, so this is less exciting, but for the 1% of us who aren't Kohanim, it turns out you didn't have to be a Kohen to light the menorah. As Rambam says, Lefichach im heitev ha-Kohen et ha-Neirot, v'hotzian lachutz mutal azar ha-Edikan. If, as long as the Kohen prepares them, this is actually the responsibility, the unique mitzvah of the Kohen. It is parashat b'ha'alotecha, hatavat ha-Neirot, cleaning. It's the grunt work. The Kohanim didn't get to do the glorious stuff. They had to do the grunt work. They had to scrub the dishes. They had to clean the menorah every day. As long as a Kohen's done that, any rando can go up, any random person whatsoever can go up and light the menorah, boom. In other words, as long as the menorah was lit, it's cool. It works. So it makes sense that Neirot Hanukkah would be a Chovat Bayit, would be an obligation on the house, because it's the same idea. As long as the candles are lit in the house, as long as the house has a flame in its window, as long as the menorah had a flame on it, it was good. It didn't matter who did it. It didn't matter how it got there. As long as the menorah was lit, it worked. As long as a house has a menorah lit within it, has a flame lit within it, the mitzvah of Hanukkah has been fulfilled. And so there seems to be this very clear thread We saw in the times of the Gemara and in the times of the Rishonim this major distinction between whether our mitzvah of Hanukkah candles is on us, we must do it, you have an obligation, or it's actually an obligation on our homes to have a Hanukkah candle lit. It creates a few interesting, you know, halachic scenarios that maybe are worth considering, but it also helps explain and understand so many of the other threads about Hanukkah. Now that you understand this, if you decide to learn more about the halachot of Hanukkah, aside from these shiurim over the coming weeks, you will see this distinction everywhere. You will see this realization. You can't buy a sefer on Hanukkah that even entertains some of the underpinnings of the halacha without them mentioning this distinction. This is the classic distinction between, for our understanding of Hanukkah candles, whether it's an obligation on us, like matzah, like sukkah, like megillah, like all these others, or whether it's part of this very interesting smaller class of mitzvot, like mezuzah, where our houses must have a flame lit with it. But I want to end with one final source. And it's the Bach Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, who's a commentator, the Torah, the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch. The most famous commentary on the Torah is the Beit Yosef by Rav Yosef Karo, which he would go on to condense into the Shulchan Aruch, the defining code of Jewish law. The second most famous, or the equally most famous commentator on the Torah is the Darchei Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who would go on to write his own condensed version and write a gloss for the Shulchan Aruch, which became the defining Ashkenazi code of Jewish law on the Shulchan Aruch. But the Bach Rav Yoel Sirkis is a very prominent commentator for the Torah. And he says something beautiful and powerful about everything we've just said. He says the following, source number 12. V'teima d'masha madlikin alav beveto. If you have Hanukkah candles lit in your house, eino ba ela liftor oto mechiyuv hamutal al mamano lahadlik neirot leparseim hanes v'rabin. All you've done is exempted yourself from needing to kind of spend your money to publicize the miracle. At the end of the day, what is the purpose of Hanukkah candles? To publicize the miracle so that people see in the streets, these are Jews celebrating this festival. That's the purpose. It's Pirsumei Nisa, publicizing the miracle. Says the Bach, as long as you have a candle lit, you fulfilled that, great. But that's all. Aval, hahoda'a al hanes, appreciation, celebration, gratitude for this miracle. Uvirkat shehechayanu, and the bracha of shehechayanu, again, thanking God. Again, this is 2020, we're in the middle of a pandemic, saying the bracha of shehechayanu has greater power now than maybe, you know, for most of us. Hu b'chiyuv al gufo. No, that's on you. You have an obligation of halel and hoda'a, of thanking God. Umizelo niftar kishemadlikin alav, im lo she'amad sham b'sha'ad bracha v'ana amen. And you only can fulfill this if you are there at the moment they are lighting the candles, answering amen, if you are taking part of that mitzvah. Says the Bach, Chovat Bayit Chovat Gavra is not two different perspectives on the mitzvah of Hanukkah, but two complementary perspectives on our obligation. On the one hand, we have an obligation to publicize the miracle. We need to let the fellow Jews in our neighborhood and the non-Jews in our neighborhood know we Jews are celebrating a miracle that took place. You know, Ruthie in a couple of weeks is going to be speaking to a company about Hanukkah because they're having this whole thing where they're trying to introduce the company to all the different, you know, things employees are celebrating. That's Pirsumei Nisa. You know, you get a giant inflatable, you know, menorah on your front lawn. I'm sure people have them. You're publicizing, okay, it doesn't substitute actual lighting Hanukkah candles, but that's all within Pirsumei Nisa. Let people know, wear your ugly Hanukkah sweaters, wear your this, wear your that. It's all letting people know we as Jews are celebrating a miracle that took place. That's a chovat bayit. That's on your house. But there's also a chovat gavra. You have an obligation. We all have an obligation of halal and hoda, of thanking God, appreciating God for the miracles he gave us back then, and the miracles he still gives us now. And that you can't pass off to someone else. That you can't delegate. That you can't outsource to someone else. Only you can do it. It's your obligation. And that's how the Bach splits the difference. These two views are not two distinct views, but two sides of the coin. And together, they can help us appreciate and understand the mitzvah of Chanukah, that we have this dual obligation to publicize the miracle through our houses, but nonetheless, as individuals, to thank God and to show our appreciation to him for the miracles he does, both in our times and the ones he used to do. It's those two aspects that come together. Next week, we are going to turn to the question of Mahadrin. Because, and then I'll take your question, iPad. We are going to turn to the question of Mahadrin. Because all we've seen thus far is the base level mitzvah of Chanukah. But you may have noticed, no one does this. Everything we've talked about until now has been premised on you light one candle in your home every night. We don't do that. What's interesting is I bet if we polled people, different people do different things. And if we polled the wider Jewish community, different people do different things. And it's going to be linked to us starting to unpack the other one of the other questions I noted emerges from our Gemara. What is Mahadrin? What is Mahadrin min ha-Mahadrin? What does it mean? What is it supposed to do? What does it look like? Is it level 2 and level 3 of this mitzvah? Or is it far more plausible when we actually think about it that actually these two views can't coexist? That these two different ways of doing the mitzvah can't actually live together because all of a sudden things will go crazy. That's what we will talk about next week.